Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A national legal settlement over the opioid crisis remains elusive, but Ohio state and local governments have forged ahead with a deal that could spell out where and how settlement funds would be spent. The latest version of the so-called One Ohio Agreement gives more power to local municipalities in hope of avoiding the mistakes of the 1998 national tobacco settlement. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Jeremy Pelzer is a politics reporter for Cleveland.com. Welcome back.
Hey, great to be here.
Julie Karsmeis, State House correspondent for the Associated Press. Welcome as always.
Good morning, Ann.
And Marty Schladen, a reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome back, Marty.
Good morning, Ann.
All right. So opioids, both in the form of prescription painkillers and illegal drugs like heroin and illicit fentanyl, have been linked to more than 430,000 deaths in the U.S. since 2000. It's just mind-boggling. When you put it in those terms, the Ohio Department of Health reported that more than 3,700 unintentional drug overdose deaths in 2018 alone, down from about 4,800 the year before. Julie, you've been writing about this deal, preparing Ohio for a future settlement with the drug companies. Where are they at right now?
They are trying to come together an initial draft of a deal that would divvy up the money, with 30% going to the local governments, 15% going to Attorney General Dave Yost's office, essentially to the state to administer, and then 55% would go to a nonprofit foundation to be administered over the long term. And as you mentioned, you know, the idea is to sort of try to avoid what happened with some of our tobacco settlement money, which was that over time, initially it was earmarked, but then over time, the lawmakers got involved and they put the money into budgets, balancing budgets, and eventually Governor Strickland, sold it, what they call, securitized it.
Yeah.
And so that he could fund a tax exemption and other things. And so they don't want that to happen. They want to make sure and put some guardrails on this to make sure that it goes back to local communities that have been hard hit.
And are still hard hit. That the idea
right.
is this is a on-the-ground crisis in a
right.
lot of places.
Right. So, but the problem is that the initial agreement, this foundation is controlling the majority of the money. Obviously, with 55 for that and then 15 for the state means that the locals don't really know how much they're guaranteed to get, and that worries them. And so the second round of a draft came out at the end of last week, and it tried to help assure them that this foundation would be able to listen to the local communities, that it's large board and the regions it would oversee, which is a little bit like how Jobs Ohio is operated.
Well, I'm wondering, okay, which brings up my question is, isn't that going to cost money to administer that?
Yes. And I mean, one of the concerns is that the description of, okay, we're going to have an executive director and we're going to have a board of experts and we're going to have to use some of this money to fund ongoing research. And some of the local leaders are saying, pshaw, we do not have to do that. We know what the crisis is. We're the experts. We don't need to study the issue. We need to address it and recompensate us for our costs.
Have they given any kind of dollar figure on what they plan to administer? Because this would be an ongoing thing.
Right. Well, I guess they're talking about $1 billion a year over 18 years, $18 billion or something like that. But that, you know, I think all that is being negotiated as well.
It should be emphasized that they don't have a settlement in place exactly yet.
They don't know what they're working
with. They don't
know
exactly how much money they are getting. They're just choosing now beforehand how to divvy it up if and when they do get a settlement between the state and all of these local governments, cities, municipalities, counties, et cetera.
Julie, do you know how that $18 billion compares to the tobacco settlement?
Off the top of my head, I don't. I think that it was double figures, billions coming into Ohio at the beginning, something like $12 billion a year. Gradually that didn't remain at such a high level because it was funding smoking cessation. And obviously this is another worry, as if in the way that the tobacco industry went downward after you know, they were attacked and settled, the same could happen to the opioid industry. They could begin to file bankruptcies and the money could dry up. And so it's always been this balance between between sort of getting as much money as can be gotten from these very wealthy companies and not putting them out of business.
And the thing is, they're on the clock because Ohio wants to be the first to have a settlement deal ready to go, because if other states settle, these companies might go out of business and Ohio might not get all their money that they're looking for because these companies simply won't exist. Or, pardon me, they won't, not that they won't exist, that they'll be in bankruptcy.
Yeah.
So they'll, they're on, it's not they're on a set tight deadline, but they're sort of in competition with states like New York, Florida, other states that are also trying to get their own opioid settlements done.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder whether this possibility of bankruptcy among these companies is a little bit overblown. And the reason I say that is, like Purdue Pharma, you know, the Sackler family appears to have structured things so they're ready for Purdue Pharma to go bankrupt, mm-hmm. but they've created other legal vehicles to, you know, produce drugs and, you know.
They've protected themselves, and that's another thing they're looking into, aren't they? Whether or not the family is personally responsible,
yes.
personally liable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes, and I don't know that we have any firm news on that
no.
yet, but I know that there's a strong sentiment out there that they've engaged in a pattern of trying to aggressively market these opioids, particularly OxyContin, which is you know, a particular culprit in this whole epidemic, and the Sacklers are believed to have you know, personally involved themselves in marketing this, or some members of the family, and now their billions are possibly protected while they, you know, created a, you know, a corporate entity that could go bankrupt.
As far as Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley, he's a Democrat. He's apparently planning to run for governor.
Mm-hmm.
He voiced concerns about the Ohio deal. What's he saying?
Well, the comments that I had from him were pre the revised version,
okay.
and some of the revision was intended to address some of the things that folks like him were saying, which has to do with, wow, this foundation is really hard to understand. There's about 25 people on the board. There are 19 regions, including Columbus would be its own region. Cincinnati would be its own region. You know, who's going to be overseeing that? And there were appointees.
Is it going to be open to the public? I mean, will it be?
No, it's appointees of the governor, appointees of the attorney general, appointees of the legislature, and then these regional experts or appointees. But interestingly, 10 appointees in the initial draft were from the non-metropolitan areas, which obviously are less populous and more Republican. And then, you know, a fewer number were from the metropolitan areas. So the big cities and big counties, which actually have been pretty successful so far in their claims, you know, have not quite cut out, but it's unclear what kind of sway they'd have.
Why 15% going to the attorney general's office?
They wanted to. Dave Yost initially wanted a constitutional amendment, and
yeah.
then he wanted to take over the suit with the idea that, you know, they need a centralized way to manage this giant amount of money. And I think the foundation is kind of a little bit of a response to that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Governor DeWine came in and was like, this isn't going that well. Let's see what we can get people to agree to. Because the concern being, you know, the state does have mechanisms such as, you know, the Department of Health or whatever to dole out money and to budget some of this stuff in a way that it would go back. But how would that work?
Also, the state, of course, has their own lawsuit. It's not just the local governments who are suing
right.
over this. Dave Yost's office is also suing, so they'll be part of any deal that's
came
struck.
In it late,
yeah.
though.
Still, but it's still a lawsuit. Still a lawsuit, and so if they're going to have a settlement that's encompassing of all these entities, the state needs to be involved in that too.
I don't know that they came in late. I mean, remember it was filed under DeWine.
That's right.
When he was.
That's right.
7 years into his attorney generalship.
Right. Well, that seemed late, but to me, but yeah.
And if you'll remember, Yost's earlier position was that the state should handle this money because the municipal and county governments are subdivisions of the state. Therefore, from as a legal matter, the state should be in charge. I think that that didn't fly at all, but that was his first position.
It does sound like a possible too many cooks in the kitchen situation, though. I mean, I'm starting to think about things like the I don't know. I mean, all these commissions and foundation. I mean, it sounds like too many details.
Yeah, 25 like members on
another,
a board.
A whole nother, a whole nother framework to deal with, a whole nother bureaucracy to manage.
That was one of Cranley's suggestions was, you know, you're creating a whole bureaucracy with no guarantees, really, of who would get the grants over the long term. And, of course, you do want to have some kind of a entity that can hang on to this money and basically treat it as an endowment so that it can grow and you can just spend off of it and keep it going longer. Because what happened with the tobacco settlement was the money started to dry up.
What will the representation, though, be of smaller, less wealthy communities that have been hit disproportionately hard? Is that been given thought?
Well, the non-metropolitan communities would get 10 votes on the board, if memory's serving. This is a lot of numbers for a Monday morning.
Sure it is.
But
that's why I really appreciate you guys coming out every
But, you know, then the metropolitan groups would have some votes. I think it was 4. But, of course, the 30% would go to the local governments off the top.
Off the top, okay.
Be divvied up in some unknown way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one issue here is that, like you said, there's so many different entities involved in the settlement itself. Like, it's hard to say. There's no major traffic cop. The governor's been helping to facilitate things. But if you're asking questions like, how many local governments have to sign on to a settlement for it to become universally accepted? No one, like, who makes that decision? Well, kind of the lawyers, but there's no real person in charge of the local governments because everyone has their own power. So it's sort of like herding cats, but you don't even have a herder.
Well, there's the Ohio Municipal League.
There is an entity that's been created by the local governments that has its own lawyers and are kind of trying to speak as one voice. And I should correct that the 30% I think would be divvied up based on the number of deaths in your community per capita, and that is something that's already been set by the judge. So that's not something, as I understand it, that's really that's helping to frame the. How that would be dispersed.
Is the judge going to have the final say in this?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, the judge, and they have to bring it to the judge and say, this is what we want, you know, this is how we want to settle it and not go to court or whatever.
Okay. This judge, Aaron Polster, he's made it clear all along he wants to see settlements in these cases. He doesn't want them to all carry to trial. So I don't know, but it seems to me that if all sides are on board, he may say yes.
We are going to continue our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Marty Schladen from the Columbus Dispatch. Also with us, Julie Carr Smythe from the Associated Press and Jeremy Pelzer from Cleveland.com. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Cleveland.com politics reporter Jeremy Pelzer, Associated Press State House correspondent Julie Carr-Smythe, and Columbus Dispatch reporter Marty Schladen. All right, Ed Choice, the Ohio General Assembly is on break, right? I mean, is that, did I read that right, or are they supposed to be gone? How are they?
I don't know.
I don't know either. It's been our reporter Anna Staver's been the one who's been covering that, and I don't know that they're out this week.
I know that. So a number of every year, and leadership of the Ohio Senate go down to Florida for their annual fundraiser, and
nice.
As my colleague Laura Hancock reported, this Ed Choice school voucher fight has really interrupted their annual Florida fundraiser. So you have people flying back and forth. So the break that they were supposed to have, I know, everyone shed a tear for Senate leadership. But, it's really cutting into their Key West time.
Wow, Key West.
Key West.
They aren't messing around then. So none of you are covering the Ed Choice issue, I take it.
No.
You're all looking at me like, my colleague.
Yeah, I can't say I'm sorry that I'm not covering it.
Okay. Did any of you hear about the video that's going around suggesting that Matt Huffman has changed his tune on this issue? No? God, okay. You're scaring me. But, and you guys don't even know if the legislature's in session or not? Somebody out there, check that for me. Okay. Are any of you covering Ohio facial recognition system?
Yes.
Okay. We get nods. We got bobbleheads in the room again. Okay. So, Jeremy Pelzer, 8.8 million Ohioans are set to have the picture from their driver's license or state issue ID uploaded into Ohio's facial recognition database. Why is this a surprise?
It's not really a surprise at all, I would say. It's just a matter that it's now happening because Ohio has a facial recognition database that the state Bureau of Criminal Investigation uses, and they take all everyone's mugshots and then everyone's state ID and driver's license photo, but only as recently as 2011. And then they put that all in the database. And if a police officer says, hey, you know, we have a suspect or we found a missing person who has amnesia or something, they can run the photo of them by all these mugshots and driver's license photos. But as I said, you know, these photos for driver's license, they're 9 years old. And if you took a driver's license photo since 2011, you're not in this database. So it's not very surprising at all that they're now trying to do this upgrade. And it's not just of the license photos. They're going to spend more than $21 million to upgrade the system to make it better to compare photos and because the system's had a real problem, they have said, identifying minorities and women.
It's been true with most AI facial recognition.
So they say this new system that they're getting from this Japanese-based company is much improved.
The issue was that this past week, a task force that Dave Yost had put together came forward with their recommendations. And part of the issue is obviously that facial recognition technology is raising all kinds of issues with people around privacy and, you know, government interference. And we have countries, that are using it to
China.
Trace people and see where they're going. And then we have concerns about the technology and social media and how far can this go to detect where you're moving about in the world. And so they're trying to kind of find a balance, as I understand it, between these very legitimate law enforcement functions of such a database and then protecting people's civil liberties and privacy.
So did Dave Yost address that in his recommendations?
Well, the task force has recommended now to him, and he says he's leaning toward, and Jeremy can correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, what he told us at the news conference was he's leaning toward accepting all of their recommendations.
Most, if not all, and he said he'll come out with that in a few weeks. It's very Mike DeWine-esque. You get a task force, and it's just these incremental steps. instead of releasing it all at once. And we asked him a few times about just the civil liberty concerns about this. Like, if you go in for a driver's license, you know, you're not... When I went in for my driver's license, I wasn't told that, hey, this is going to be in a database of how many million people that they'll use to check. And the attorney general's answer to that is, well, you're taking these photos for identification. Like, you're taking these photos so if a cop pulls you over, you have to show the cop your photo to show it's you. And this is just another method of doing that. I mean, I guess I push back.
Or another way to use the same data.
Another way of using the same data. I push back. I mean, it's like, well, it's not. He's like, well, it's optional. You don't have to get a driver's license. But on the other hand, especially if you're in Columbus, like.
Yeah, you do.
You kind of need a driver's license. You know, it's not like if you want to opt out of this program, you have to get a job within walking distance.
I guess I could hire a chauffeur, but, you know, not everybody. There aren't enough to go around, I'm sure.
This is, you know, part of an even bigger phenomenon, though, and it's all driven by technology, and I don't know how I feel about it one way or the other. There's a company, a tech company in California that is scraping the internet, all social media for photos, and they're doing some highly advanced facial recognition stuff, and which also sounds scary. I mean, I don't even have control over the photos of me that get posted on social media.
I'm sure it's many thousands.
Many embarrassing photos.
They're all embarrassing. There's just not that many of them. So on the one hand, you've got that, and that I'm not feeling very comfortable with that. You know, same thing with genetic information that gets posted to genealogy databases. But the fact that that information is in those databases has allowed police departments to solve very cold cases, cases that they don't have any idea. You know, they call them whodunits. And this is helping them redress some really bad stuff. But still there's that fear that, you know, when do we become like the Uyghurs in China, like, and, you know, referred to where they've put all this stuff out where you're walking past cameras all day, every day. And if the government wants to in China, it sounds like, you know, for certain populations, they know where you are all the time.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable, and the legislature is in session this week, but not today. So I've been corrected. I don't know where. Maybe I dreamed it.
Mark our calendars.
Yes.
That's why you threw us off. We're like, I know. Where could they be? Like,
where else could they be? So everybody's checking. But I've been told by my producers that they are, and I'm just making stuff up now. So, yeah, Jeremy.
Oh, well, all I was going to say is I think the concerns about this facial recognition have been summarized actually by one of the comments on a story I did. And, you know, Yost has denied that previously when he looked into this facial recognition program, he denied, he's like, we found no evidence that this was misused for surveillance of groups or used, you know, for illicit means or anything wrong. But I mean, that, as his commenter noted, that the very fact that you have to deny it means that you can do it. You know, so even if they're not misusing it now, I think the fear is down the line, as Marty was saying, this technology really can be used for that kind of stuff.
Does anybody watch Black Mirror? Just me?
Yes. What a show. Right. And I mean, I think that when Marty mentions the DNA and all these things are incredibly robust and promising tools for things like law enforcers who want to be able to catch the bad guys and all that stuff. But, you know, it is a very scary kind of Big Brother type worry that people have about how it will all unfold and how much we will know about what's out there about us and who is looking at it.
Yeah, imagine if the Nixon administration had access to this kind of information.
To play devil's advocate, though.
Jeez, Murray.
Yeah. Joe McCarthy. You know,
good old skeptical journalism. I would say, well, to play devil's advocate, I mean, police departments for decades have had access to driver's license photos. Mm-hmm. They just haven't been in a computer. They've been just literally books of driver's license photos. So, you know, the Nixon administration could have had access to this. It would just be in analog form and not digital form.
Well, even in digital, even for a long time with digital, they didn't have facial recognition.
Absolutely.
That's a different technology altogether. That's the next step.
But to play devil's advocate, it's not like this just came out of whole cloth. This is just a continuation of things that have already been done for a long time, whether you agree with it or not.
But the issue of whether or not it errs more often or disproportionately when it comes to people of color, and especially African-American males, is of concern, you know, perpetuating a system that already disproportionately targets African-American males.
Absolutely.
Yeah. BMV automatic voter registration petition. Does this ring any bells?
Oh, yeah.
Jeremy Pelzer, backers of a petition to let Ohioans automatically be registered to vote when they go to the BMV, got the go-ahead Thursday to start collecting signatures.
They can. It's another automatic voter registration drive, and we'll see if they can get it on the ballot. It's one of a number of ballot measures that are being advanced now for November.
So this has gone through the Attorney General and the Secretary of State's office?
Well, yeah.
And the language?
You have to go through, like any ballot issue, right. You have to go through these hoops. You have to get your summary certified. You have to get an initial batch of signatures. You have to go through the ballot board. And then when you pass those kind of procedural hoops, then you can begin the real challenge, which is collecting the hundreds of thousands of signatures needed to actually make the ballot.
430,000.
But who's counting? And so, that's going to be the real hurdle for them to do it.
It would also require early voting locations on the two weekends before Election Day and grants same day voter registration. That's a rub for a lot of people, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a poke in the eye to, I mean, this has been an issue for years about early voter registration, especially if you remember Golden Week, the week in October where until they closed it, you could register to vote and vote during the same week. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, immediately shut down quickly shut down by Republican lawmakers. And now they're going to try to go to the ballot over it.
So does this existence a little bit of tension with the aggressive voter purging we're doing here in Ohio?
Well, it's being advanced by different groups. Yeah, I think it absolutely is related. You have groups who are Democratic, more liberal groups who are very opposed to efforts by Secretary of State Frank LaRose and his predecessor, John Houston, to purge inactive voters from voter rolls. And this would be one way to address that problem, because if everyone's automatically registered to vote when they move, it's much harder to have that be a problem, if you agree with that.
Just remembering, though, that law has been around for a long time. I mean, secretaries of state of both parties have enforced it over the years.
The voter purge, yeah.
But it really came out as an issue and became sort of front of mind under John Husted, because, you know, turnout was going to be so important to that particular race. And I just think that this is the kind of ballot issue that probably, if it makes it, is going to maybe drive some turnout on the Democratic side, probably is going to it's very difficult for the opposition to run ads against it, right? Because it's all about opening our democratic process. But we did see over the weekend that the Trump campaign is getting ready to pour a bunch of money into fighting the voting lawsuits that have been that are out there on grounds that they are trying to protect against voter fraud, which we know over many, many years is a very, very rare thing.
As far as the group that's behind this petition, are they funded well enough? I mean, getting 430,000 signatures is tougher than it looks. You got to get a certain number of counties and all that kind of stuff. Jeremy, I mean, do they have what it's going to take?
It's not just money; it's manpower.
Well, that costs money. Yeah,
I'm sorry. Yeah, but it requires you to go to 44 different counties and get, like you said, 400,000 and some odd signatures. Yeah, it's going to require money, and it's going to require money not just to get it on the ballot, but then if they actually get it on the ballot, then they have to spend more money to get it passed. So, yeah, it's a significant hurdle for anyone. It's really interesting, and how you have these lawmakers complaining about how there's this cottage industry of all these Columbus insiders and downtown Columbus, these political groups that just make their money by kind of going to get people to try to get these ballot initiatives passed, yeah. and so they can rake in the money. But then they respond to that by raising the standards, making it even harder for anyone except those political people to get it on the ballot. And it's just a really interesting sort of catch-22. Uh-huh. And just in general.
Well, and then a lot of times people will say, correct me if I'm wrong, that we wouldn't have to work on getting things on the ballot in Ohio if the Ohio General Assembly took up the issues that are before them in the first place.
Well, many of the things that wind up heading toward the ballot, right, are things that have a really broad swath of public support, and yet the legislature has not acted on them. We look at medical marijuana, which there was a ballot issue that kind of pushed that issue.
Payday lending,
these kind of things. And they do tend to get the attention of the General Assembly, and then they maybe turn around and quickly pass something to avoid having to face that on the ballot. Because and a lot of times the argument is, well, we can write it better if we're more deliberative and we're not responding to some outside group. Mm.
I know that there are critics of, you know, governing through initiative and referendum because, you know, just because something sounds good in a few sentences doesn't necessarily mean that it's good policy. But like you say, if the legislative body is ignoring the clear will of the public, it's got to have somewhere to flow.
We will continue our conversation. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. I'm Ann Fisher. With me, Jeremy Pelzer of Cleveland.com, Julie Carr-Smythe of the Associated Press, and Marty Schladen for the Columbus Dispatch. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Cleveland.com politics reporter Jeremy Pelzer, Associated Press Statehouse correspondent Julie Carr-Smythe, and Columbus Dispatch reporter Marty Schladen. There, for the first time since November, a Senate committee heard testimony last week on a bill that could eliminate or would eliminate the time limit on prosecuting rapes in Ohio. Julie Carr-Smythe, what's the impetus for this?
Well, I think that they have been working to the Ohio State case with Dr. Strauss has been very concerning to people. And so there was an individual bill that said, let's open this up so that those victims of this doctor, now dead doctor, could file suit, and you would lift the statute of limitations and allow that. And some A Democrat, I think, in particular, came back and said, wait a minute, why are we only doing this for these male victims, alleged male victims of this doctor? We should do that for women and men. And if we're going to lift it, we should just lift it.
All rape victims.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's what's been going on. There's kind of this clash between the two bills and the two chambers over how that would look and whether it's the right thing to do.
And it seems to me that it's in response to the institutional nature of a lot of these crimes. You know, Strauss did what he did for all these years, and Ohio State didn't do much to police him. We've seen the same thing in the Catholic Church. We're looking at Harvey
Michigan
Weinstein.
State, University Michigan. Of Michigan, Harvey Weinstein. Yeah, right.
Yeah. And so it seems to me that that's what's going on here is, that, you know, it's a way of making the institutions who covered this sort of thing up liable for doing so.
The current limit is 25 years with possible 5-year extension with DNA evidence. The limit was just 6 years until 1999, which is kind of shocking. It does say something about how we're evolving in terms of our our sensibilities about rape and the lasting impacts of it.
Right. And I think that there is a lot of proof that the victims of sexual violence often don't come forward in the moment. They often maybe mature and grow, come to later parts of their life and realize how much something like that is affecting them. And so the idea is, well, you know, you put this limit on it at a time when it's a very sensitive issue, when that person is still alive and maybe even in their life. In the case of, as Marty mentions, like priests and young children or college football or these various athletic things. Now, we've seen it with the Boy Scouts, the same thing. Like, these people are not really going to be in a position to speak to authority in that way within a six-year period.
Another layer to this is that Amelia Sykes, the minority leader, she actually criticized top legislative leaders, male legislative leaders, basically accusing them of sexism because they're moving the Ohio State bill, but they're not moving her bill to that would just generally get away, do away with statutes of limitations for rape. And so there's been some criticism, accusations of sexism thrown around in this as well.
Mm-hmm. There's another piece of the legislation that has to do with this marital rape loophole, which I wrote about last year. But there are Ohio is among states that still say that if you are raped by your spouse, that it's not a crime. And it's a really interesting loophole that goes way back to medieval times when parts of English common law suggested that rape was impossible with inside marriage because it was implied that sexual consent was implied when you married someone.
Well, it was ownership. I mean, right. Women were chattel.
Right. So that's another piece that's in the broader bill that has to do with all lifting this for all everyone.
Eliminating statutes of limitations or extending them far back is not going to be without its own complications, though. Obviously, you know, the evidence grows cold. It's going to be a tougher thing to adjudicate the older the allegation is.
There is the issue of tort reform, too, which occurred 20 years odd years ago, and the limits on, what you can recover. Is that a part of all this?
I don't think it's a part of this particular bill.
Not really, not so far.
Okay. The House Democrats are pushing for a hotline where people could anonymously report wage discrimination.
Correct. It's it's speaking of Amelia Sykes,
House Minority Leader, head of the
Ohio House Democrats, the caucus. This is something they've been pushing for a while, especially since Amelia Sykes became Minority Leader last year. They're wanting an anonymous hotline where people can call and report. Instances of wage discrimination.
What would they do with that?
I would defer to my colleagues on that. I know basically what it does. I don't know the details.
Well, I don't either. But I guess I would say that they're looking toward patterns that maybe they could draw out. And obviously, within the Democratic caucus, they've often tried to address in legislation that really goes nowhere, the wage gap, gender discrimination in wage. And, it's a fact gathering for them to be able to find cases around the state that maybe they can use to illustrate the importance of some legislation that they would want.
Sort of diagnosing the problem.
But if it's anonymous and it's just a hotline, then I'm just wondering what you really get from it.
The idea would be that you're naming your employer, though, even if the person reporting it is anonymous. So then ideally, then it could be referred to state officials for investigation and possible prosecution. If you're it's just sort of like a tip line against employers, I think is what the idea is.
Huh. Well, they've been wanting it for years. It's a Democratic initiative. And the Democrats, as far as I can tell, have absolutely no real power in the Ohio General Assembly at this point. What do you think the odds are something like this will get through?
Not much better than they have been the past few years, but Democrats have had a little bit more power this time around just because they've been willing to work with the House Speaker. But, you know, it went from near zero to a little bit greater than near zero. So it depends what they negotiate.
But they did give him key votes to win the speakership. And
true.
So he has pledged to work in a bipartisan manner. And, you know, he's been doing that to some extent. This is Larry Householder
right.
we're talking about. And so, you know, they're always, as lawmakers, testing the waters of the things that are going to rise to the level of needing legislation. And maybe that's what she's after here.
The issue, too, is that the Ohio Chamber of Commerce and a lot of business groups are against this, too. So
I
this
would imagine,
has opponents.
Yeah.
This
yeah.
isn't just people not caring.
Okay.
But don't you think Householder has showed himself to be willing to step away from Republican orthodoxy on different issues?
Yeah, I'll grant you that.
Very safe to say.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, right. And I mean, he has been vocal on this whole issue of getting that maybe we need to revisit the death penalty,
right.
which is certainly not something that's been a common Republican view.
And one thing he really struck me by during the excellent AP day where we met with the leaders of the House and the Senate and the governor, he didn't just cite the practical issues with the death penalty. He seemed to say he philosophically could see where it's better to leave, for example, Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh in prison for the rest of his life, thinking about the children he blew up, instead of allowing him to forego his appeals and just die. And you know, that to me is a pretty deep argument against the death penalty.
Yes, and just last week we saw a conservative, an unusual conservative coalition come together around this issue, including former Governor Bob Taft,
right.
and looking at this or beginning maybe to coalesce around this kind of a push to get rid of the death penalty. It is expensive, and some folks have said it's not a good argument to look at the money that it costs to keep someone on death row and allow them to continue to fight that. But it's interesting that the philosophical arguments are beginning to come out, too.
One of the crafters of the bill that created, you know, brought back the death penalty back in the 80s, Paul Pfeiffer, former member of the Ohio Senate, former member of the Ohio Supreme Court, has now said he opposes the death penalty, regrets it. A former attorney general,
Jim Petro,
both of these, by the way, Republicans, now lobbies and proselytizes and written a book about why the death penalty doesn't work. And I thought it was interesting that former Senate President Dick Finan, in response to this latest effort by this coalition of conservatives, is kind of lashing out, saying he thinks that it just takes too long to have the death penalty take place, that it should be only a year or two. It shouldn't go on for decades like it does. That kind of flies in the face of what the evidence is about whether or not the death penalty is actually fairly meted out or even properly.
I would say reports of the death of the death penalty in Ohio are pretty premature at this point. If you look at the people we've been talking about, they're all former office holders. They do not currently hold power.
Except for Larry Householder.
Who hasn't said he's against the death penalty. He said he's open to looking at other things and he's hedged his bets. They're still talking. There's no bill to
right.
get rid of the death penalty. Only three lawmakers in this conservatives against the death penalty group. There's only three current lawmakers in this. So yeah, they're talking about it. Yeah, there's growing opposition to it, but we're a long way from passing this, especially because Senate President Larry Obhoff has said, no, that we have a majority of our folks who are still in favor of the death penalty, and he said we're not going to pass anything before the end of the year.
Do you think this is just politics then? It's to appear to be softening on the issue.
I don't think it's that at all. I think there's a clear problem with the death penalty in Ohio. We have basically a forced moratorium on the death penalty now because of the so many problems we've had. And the question is, what do you do with it? Do you just kind of like linger on? And some people are saying, okay, we got to do something. And I don't think it's cynical politics, but I do think it's a tough sled. I mean, if it was easy, it would have been done by now.
Right. And the, the lack of drugs to administer lethal injection has been a huge problem, not just here, but elsewhere in the country. And so that's an issue. And we just saw this last week in the case of Pardon here in Columbus, that the jury did not give him the death penalty, right? They decided to give him life without parole. And so this idea of life without parole has definitely become more popular, if you will, in recent years.
It's a relatively recent option.
Right. And even prosecutors are more often, as I understand it, more often recommending that over the death penalty.
The person to watch, the person who hasn't weighed in on this, is Mike DeWine.
Well,
he has.
When you ask him.
Point blank, right.
When you ask him if he supports the death penalty, he will not answer your question.
Right. He won't.
He's frozen it. He's done by his actions. But he has not weighed in on whether he favors getting rid of the death penalty.
Mm-hmm. And I think, that's maybe where politics comes into play, too. What he might think in his heart of hearts may not be a politically expedient thing to say.
Yeah.
But, just nationally, public opinion is starting to move against the death penalty. It's still pretty evenly split.
Yeah.
Executions are way down. Death penalty sentences are way down. Something this big doesn't change overnight. And you're right, Jeremy. As long as the Senate president and the Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association are set against this, you're not going to pass a law, but we're still in this place where we're not killing anybody.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you could, going back to the ballot issue, if it feels like it's beginning to burgeon as this sort of public wave, you could take it to the ballot, which might force the hand of the legislature.
Interestingly, it's still pretty split down the middle. Ohio and nationally, it's interesting that it kind of waves around up there, but all things being equal, is pretty split. So I'm wondering, meanwhile, back at the ranch, though, these appeals continue for people who are on death row. The wheels of justice, so to speak, keep turning one way or the other. It still costs Ohioans money to litigate, or not litigate, but to hear and to try and try these appeals and that kind of a thing.
And I'd be interested to hear Mr. Finan explain how you condense that process into a couple of years.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, it's kind of crazy. I don't even know what he's talking about with that. But he did say it. I think he told Randy Ludlow of the Dispatch. I read it in the Columbus Dispatch on Sunday. So it's kind of interesting. And he would, I'm sure he's a lawyer, and he would know that it's not legal.
Well, and I look in the court file pretty regularly, the federal court file where the death penalty litigation is taking place in Dayton. And there are new filings in there constantly, and there are hundreds of them. I just don't know how you take that and just, make it into a rocket docket.
Yeah, the interesting thing to me, politically speaking, is what happens with the pro-life messaging around abortion, and is there going
to
be a coalition?
Right.
Is there going to be this coalition that starts to say, this is a purist way of looking at a pro-life argument? And I feel like, if we do get Mike DeWine to talk about this, that's kind of where he may be heading mentally. And, we're all just guessing. We're political reporters, but it just feels like there's some issues around that.
And that sentiment certainly exists out there that if you're pro-life, it means, birth, death.
Birth through death, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's it's you're right. I mean, Jeremy, your point's really well taken that this is not on this the skids are not greased yet, but that they're having these kind of conversations, that they're initiating these conversations in the Republican Party, you know, among people that you can't imagine would have been talking about it before. It says something, but right, how long?
Right, and I mean,
totally agree.
Circling back to our talk about technology, I mean, DNA is changing,
yeah.
And the world's changing.
World's a changing place. Julie Karsmeyer, State House correspondent for the Associated Press, thanks for your time today.
You're welcome.
Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter for Cleveland.com, you too.
Hey, thanks as always.
And Marty Schladen, reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, thanks for your time.
Good to see you, Ann.
Thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.